And I'm supposed to return order to this pandemonium. 9,500 unsatisfied people who didn't win the horse. Like, talk about an uphill climb. Just before I start, I'd like to say something. And that's that despite how Lenny acts and treats people at the public level, when you come here and you're invited here by Lenny, he takes you out and shows you the retreat, and he takes you out and shows you the falls and the gorge. And I've been in Portland I don't know how many times, and nobody's ever taken me anywhere. The only thing that he didn't do was pick me up at the airport. Because he sent Lenny E. to pick me up in the airport, which was probably good because I got to my room in a minimal amount of time. Two near crashes, but nothing too serious, a little swearing, but it's a typical alcoholic ride. And I want to say congratulations to the man with 48 years of sobriety. I wanted the newcomers to see what they're going to look like if they keep hanging around. Hey, listen, for 106, he looks great. I mean, I am just about the same age as you are, not sobriety-wise, but physically. I'm 47, so you sobered up the year before I was born, which left some room for a new pig at the trough, and it's a good thing. Well, so as one person, I won't take any time to offend. I've already done that. Do you know, you new people in the room, how to tell which of the people is going to be talking at the conference or this meeting? It's always the ass with the suit and the tie, right? Everybody else is comfortable. You got one fool in from out of town with a suit and tie, and that's how you know. And the one that's introducing him is local, so they're cool. They've got a suit with no tie. That's how you can tell. That's the deal. It's great. Anyway, my name is Marty Jeffrey, and I'm an alcoholic. And I don't know if you do this here, but many places that I talk, they ask that if you give your sobriety date as they have a train drive by. And I had my last drink of alcohol or smoke of Merry Wonderful or anything like that. It was February the 8th of 1976. And what I wrote in that book for that fellow that was 4 days sober was that every day you get an Alcoholics Anonymous they can't take back. And I don't know anything else that kept me sober in the beginning but that. I thought, man, I'm the kind of a guy that if I ever got sober and ever got happy, I'd be walking across the street and I'd be run down by a beer truck. I mean, that's just the kind of crap luck that I have. And then one day it dawned on me, my God, you know, they can't take it back. If I just stayed sober all day today and nothing bad happened to me, they can't get that back from me. It's mine for once and forever. And I have stayed sober on that premise these 23 years. And I'm one of those people that believes that I live with a daily reprieve. And it's contingent. It's a contingent reprieve on the maintenance of my spiritual condition. So I'm going to do some stuff tonight that you may or may not like. I'm going to tell it the way that I see it. I'm going to share my experience. I really believe we make a mistake in a lot of meetings. I hear people say that the book tells us to talk about what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And that's not what the book says. The book says clearly what we were like, what happened, and what we are like now. So I can't... What's the point of telling you what it was like? It sucked. It sucked then. It can suck now. It continues to suck. It just... And when you come in and you're new, they say it gets better. No, it sucks. You get better, but it continues to suck. And any old-timer in this room that's not lying to you, it's just the truth. I mean, the world is not going to get down on its hands and knees and start to celebrate your sobriety, I guarantee you. There is some wiener released every morning to get in front of you with his car. And just cut you off and infuriate you. There's people sent to aggravate you. In Alcoholics Anonymous, we call them family. Yes. Oh, yes. These are the ones. They know all the buttons and the code. And they share with you the level of your understanding, you know. And so I just want to talk a little bit about what we were like. And I can say we clearly, I had a committee in my head. I think most alcoholics can identify with that. I had this one set of voices that cried for more and another set of voices that said stop. And I had my father and I had some people that I admired, school teachers. I started drinking at the age of 11. That's no big record. Our 48-year member told me he started drinking at 8. I'm sure there's somebody in here, prenatal, you know. It doesn't matter what you say at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, somebody's done worse. You know, you could get up here and say, I made love to a zebra. Somebody says, well, at least the one you had was female. It doesn't matter what you say at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's the only group in the world. I mean, we come here saying I'm not like that, and within 3 or 4 months, we're the worst one, the worst alcoholic that ever lived. You know, you people don't understand how I feel, you know. But I want to talk to you a little bit about what precipitated my drinking, because I really believe that there is a statement in the big book that describes me so perfectly and completely in one sentence that it's amazing that Bill had never met me before he decided to pen that book. I'm serious. And the statement is that we were powerless over alcohol. We had to admit we were powerless over alcohol. And then there's this sort of a dash, an M space, they call it in printing. And it says we had to admit that our lives had become unmanageable. You see, it doesn't say that we admit that we're powerless over alcohol and powerless over our lives. It says that we're powerless over alcohol and our lives have become unmanageable. And if you want to describe everything that's wrong with me in the whole world, that's it. That's the entire thing. That is the problem. And you see, I didn't get that. This powerless over alcohol thing, I mean, I was 90 days sober driving down a freeway in a place called Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, when I realized, my God, I'm alcoholic. I'm serious. I'd been to like hundreds of meetings. I had a sponsor. I was not sponsored. I was kidnapped. And I was held hostage by a man that told me we are anonymous because we have hundreds of people watching you. That's true. I love him with all my heart and soul. And to hear me talk, sometimes you'd think I didn't. So I want to make that very clear. I had the opportunity about a month and a half ago to share this story that I now have in front of that man, and I haven't seen him for a number of years. He said, you know, the only reason I kidnapped you is because I was so desperate myself I needed a newcomer. You were nothing special. See, I didn't get the alcoholic part. Alcoholic. My God, you know, alcohol. You know, call me anything, but don't call me alcoholic, you know what I'd say? That is such a scungy, dirty, filthy, you know, child molester, yes, but not alcohol. Jeez, not a alcohol. Because that was associated to something I loved to do, which was drink alcohol. I laugh at us at meetings. We get up, somebody say, my name is Marty and I'm a alcoholic addict. That's from the Department of Redundancy Department. Believe me, it's because Dr. Silkworth said we are addicted to alcohol. That's where the word alcoholic comes from. Alcohol addict. Push it together. Alcoholic. It's true. Yeah. But we seem to like to tell everybody everything we are when we start off, you know. But anyway, I'm an alcoholic. So this powerlessness would mean that, and sometimes in understanding things, the best way I can do is turn around backwards. I must have come in here believing that I was powerful over alcohol and that my life had become manageable. Because they were trying to get me to admit, which is difficult with an alcoholic. The only people in the world that only had 2 drinks. I swear to God. You know, we're puking blood, and how many did you have? Two. You know. And somebody pissed my pants, too. It's the... But, powerless... The concept of powerlessness eluded me for a period of time. And I'm driving down this freeway after about 90 meetings. And all of a sudden it dawns on me, oh, my God. This is a progressive fatal disorder. I could die if I drink and I go into a panic. And so I phone this guy, and I say, oh, my God. He says, shut up. What do you want? I said, Dwayne, I'm an alcoholic. And there was just dead silence on the other end of the phone. He said, Oh, God, it's unanimous now. Everybody bloody understands that you're alcoholic. I said, you don't understand what I'm saying. I will die from this disease. He said, let me understand what you're saying. He said, what I'm hearing you say is if you don't put it in your mouth, you could bath in it and you would not die. Just don't drink it. I thought, well, that's not good enough. I want to understand what's wrong with me, and I need to understand what's wrong with me. So I went to this guy's, he was in the alcoholism business, right? Which was crazy. But I went to his associate, who was an educated man, very educated. And I said, Bob, I believe that I might have this alcoholism. And he said, oh, I believe you do too. And I said, well, what is the medical description of alcoholism? And he said, you have a biochemical disorder centering in the hypothalamic information control center of your brain. And that's made worse by your liver's inability to metabolize alcohol without producing acetaldehyde, which mixed with dopamine produces tetrahydroisoquinoline. And that's a nasty combination given your narcissistic egocentric core. Nasty combination given your narcissistic egocentric core, which is driven at times by feelings of omnipotence which tend toward their own integrity in spite of the cognitive dissonance and stimulus augmentation. So what does that mean? He said, your drinker is broke. Oh. Powerless over alcohol. Oh. Now it's starting to come clear. You see, understanding it doesn't make any difference. The fact that I have a hypothalamic information control center in my brain which craves the next hit makes absolutely no difference when I'm craving the next hit. You see, the thing about alcoholism is I didn't understand it until I read a book called Alcoholics Anonymous. I heard countless people try to describe in countless stories. I heard people at these podiums, 47 minutes of their talk was about getting juiced. What they did, where they been, who they beat up, da-da-da-da-da-da. Didn't help me. Didn't help me. The Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous is one of the single most important factors of my life. However, the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is the thing which divided the line between dying and staying here. And what happened to me was an old boy named Franklin Williams. Do you, any of you remember Franklin? He was like 110 years old, and he always used to say, I was trying to decide whether I should listen to that old teen speaker or go pee, and I know right now I've made the wrong choice. He used to say it every time he talked. Old Franklin described himself as a real alcoholic. A real alcoholic. And I thought, what the hell's the difference between like, who'd want to be a pretend one? See what I'm saying? And I said, what is a real alcoholic? And he said, go to your big book and find it. He said, it only appears in the book once. And so I started to dig. I was one of those alcoholics that had to know. And so I found this thing in the book. And if you are new in the room today and you have been trying to decide whether you've had enough or whether you've been bad enough or you've been beaten up enough or you've lost enough or haven't lost enough, it doesn't matter. Here's what matters. It says it a couple of times in the chapter to the act. I'll get that. Hello. This never used to happen when I first came here. There were no cell phones. It's a union beef. But anyway, see, in the chapter to the agnostics, the chapter 4, it starts off and it says, you know, if you find that you can't control the amount you drink once you start to drink, you may be alcoholic. That's sort of like saying, if you're female and your belly protrudes after several months of not having periods, you may be pregnant. Trust me when I tell you this, earth people don't get that drinking themselves thirsty thing that happens to us. They have a few drinks, they burp, they puke, sometimes they get drunk. They never get thirstier and thirstier and thirstier the more they drink. It does not happen to them. This is what is sometimes described in very confused terms in the big book as a heavy drinker. They are drinking for the companionship, the acceleration, the fun, to be with the lunatics like us. And then for some reason, health, marriage breaks down, whatever, they stop drinking. They never think about it again. That's not us. We're people that once we start to drink, we cannot control the amount we drink. And then on top of that, and this powerless thing that I have is so goofy, because just before I take the drink, I cannot remember why I shouldn't be drinking. I honestly cannot bring into my mind, the book says, with sufficient force, kind of like a little way out there, you know, oh, geez, you know, fishbowl, peed in it, police, car, doesn't matter now. I'll have this beer and I'll be better, you know. So that I can't bring into my mind sufficient force the suffering and the humiliation of even a week or a month before that I am without defense against the first drink. That is powerlessness. You see, and people like us wouldn't drink if we weren't powerless. If it couldn't take you to a different place or position, what the hell would be the use of drinking? These idiots that are trying to figure out how to get us to drink normally, what the hell for? What are we going to do, have two drinks? If it doesn't go bajoing, boing, boom, bam, zing, I don't want any. You know what I'm saying? Like, I don't drink for that. I drink to get different. See, when I drink, I go outside, in. I'm all of a sudden, what I had inside comes outside, and I share it with you. Oh, yeah. Like it or not. And usually you didn't. See, I was one of these alcoholics who was very, very sort of the affable, fun guy, sober, but when I drank, I didn't speak. Very rarely talked. And what I would just do is I would find one of you that was particularly annoying me, and I would go over and I would slap you up alongside of the head, and then you'd beat me up. I did it all the time. And I don't know why. I don't know why I got angry like that. I don't know why my father threw me down two flights of stairs on Christmas night. Beat me up so bad I ended up the rest of the night licking my wounds under a table in some strange house. I don't know why. I don't know why, you know, the book talks about incomprehensible demoralization. Pitiful. Pitiful. God, did anybody in here start out to be pitiful? Like, I shoot me, but don't let me be pitiful, for God's sake. Not pitiful. And if I am pitiful, I'm more pitiful than you are anyway. I'll show you pitiful, you know. It's incomprehensible. Demoralization, a moral is a truth that you hold within. And it's a guiding inner truth that you know. Nobody ever teaches you a moral. You know. And when you're demoralized means that these inner truths of yours have been plucked away from you, that you no longer possess the things in which you believe. Why would anybody want to do that? And the answer is because they are powerless to stop it. That's why it says that we also have to admit that our lives have become unmanageable. See, I think I have a part of my mind that was installed by an aviation corporation. It's an autopilot. Because I go to land in Los Angeles and I see the plane clearly going down in Las Vegas and I'm fighting it. You know, I want to go over here and I say to my wife, I'll be home. Count on it. And then I start going this way, against my own will. I'm with people I don't like, drinking stuff I don't like, against my own will, because I'm not like that up here. Everything that I was, I used to say to people when I was 18 years old, let's have a drink. You'll see everything that I am in the bottom of that bottle of scotch by the end of the night. How would you know that? I intuitively knew these things. The unpredictability and the unmanageability is in truth what got me to Alcoholics Anonymous. Because, I mean, one more time, I went out not to drink. Anybody do that? You know, I keep hearing these people talk about, every time I drank, I went out to get drunk. Well, that might have been true in my early drinking, but at the end, every time I went out to not get drunk. Just to get a little, you know, just a buzz. Just enough until my hair came back. Yeah, tell us, Matt. So, all I wanted to do every time I drank, at the end of the time I drank, was just get different. I wanted to be anything except what I knew I was. And I would get into that place, you know. Unfortunately, it's very short at the end of your drinking. If you're like me, that condition of being in a euphoric state became very abbreviated. I later came to understand that alcoholics, unlike normal people, and this is tricky, you see, because if you're drinking and you're alcoholic, you don't know that when they're sitting beside you as non-alcoholics drinking, what they're experiencing is different than what you're experiencing. You don't understand that your body thinks that you're drinking water. And so it fills your cells up with water, and alcohol is not as turgid as cells, and so the cells collapse. And what you're actually experiencing in your mind is a death syndrome. It's the dying of the human brain. It's a very euphoric state. I love that, you know. Go out, kill a few brain cells, you know. And my thing was always, hell, I've got millions of them I'm not using. I did not know until years sober that it's an indiscriminate process. You can hurt the ones in the front or ones at the back. Completely indiscriminate. And so everybody that drinks should look out. It's a serious thing when you're killing those brain cells. But that sensation, that wonderful sense of, and I looked for words for this for years and years, and the best I could describe it to you is like this, that when I drank for a short period of time, I felt all in one place, all at the same time. I never had that at any other time. The unpredictable, unmanageable sense of me sober was simply that when I was in position A, I thought I should be at B. If I was drinking in the King George, I thought I should have been in the Princess. If I was with Shirley, I thought I should have been with Mary. No matter what I was doing, I was always in the wrong place with the wrong people. There was this restless, irritable, discontent thing that Dr. Silkworth talked about that plagued me, not only drinking. You see, here's another big tip if you're new. You're nuts. Yeah. I didn't know how to slide that to you, so I thought I'd just pop it out. You see, we're all here because we're not all there. We are people who have lost the ability to judge between what's true and what's untrue. We've become to believe that things that are not good for us are what we want. The isolation and the loneliness, the unmanageable, unpredictable madness of having nothing going on in your life that you want and continuing to do the same things to try and create it is what we talk about when we talk about insanity in Alcoholics Anonymous. The most insane thing any person in this room who is suffering from alcoholism could do is to take a drink. People say to me, how do you know if you're restored to sanity? I tell them, you know that as soon as you don't want to drink anymore. Because I don't remember from age 11 on ever not wanting to drink. People say, don't you wish you could drink? I say, this is the first time I ever had a choice. What in the hell are you talking about? When I took that first drink, it was never a choice after that. I always had to drink. You had liquor, I had to drink. And today, I don't have to drink. I can always drink. I have a choice. Today I choose not to drink. And every day I don't drink, they can't take back. So, if my problem is unmanageability and powerlessness, obviously the answer does not lie within or I'd have solved it a long time ago. I mean, I tried to gain control. The illusion of the alcoholic is that somehow we will wrest satisfaction out of life if we only manage well. Let me put that another way. We are so egocentric, so selfish and self-centered, we honestly believe that we can bring order to chaos. We believe we're the only human beings on earth that can fix it. You know what I'm saying? And then we've got these crazy people that hang around us called Al-Anon. They're dumber than we are. They think they can fix us. My God. We're trying to control the liquor. They're trying to control us. It's like a sick contest. Who's nuttier on any given day? You know, those lines in the Al-Anon's heads, that's not age. Those are from Venetian blinds as they're standing. You know. It's insane. They wait every day. They're waiting every day for your sanity to return. Hello? Hot tip for you. You know what? If most of us just don't drink extended periods of time, it gets better. Never mind sanity return. I mean, for some of that's a very slow process. Now, I had, as I told you, this big, almost cathartic type revelation. My God, I'm alcoholic. And from that moment, I swear to God, I knew that if I saw a bottle of whiskey, I might as well look at it with a skull and crossbones on that bottle, because for me to drink is for me to die. I never had any doubt. Whether or not I would survive was a big question mark in my mind. I came here looking for a bridge to run my car into. I was not sure in sobriety that I could stand the pressure of each and every day. I couldn't believe that anything, your stupid little 12 steps, when I saw those babies, I thought, what am I going to do this afternoon? I'll do those this morning. Yeah, any of the rest of you think you're a little brighter than the rest when you got here? I mean, I'm 23 years old. I get picked up by this guy named Dwayne, who's probably 50. He's a liar. Says he hasn't had a drink of alcohol for 13 years. Get the hell out of here, Dwayne. That's what I'm thinking. Like, come on, go pull the other one, right? He says a number of incidents and stories. This is a classic 12-step call out of his experience. I think, God, you know, he's a bigger jerk than I am. So I start telling him some of my stuff, and pretty soon he says to me, again, this is the key. He says, even if you're not alcoholic, don't you agree that if you didn't drink, you'd get in less trouble? I had never consciously thought that before. This is the disease that denies you have it. And so when he said, don't you think you'd get in less trouble, I started to kind of go on a mental journey. And I recognized, my God, almost every time I'm in trouble, I'm drunk. It was like, wow, a revelation. I used to say, man, if I wouldn't have been drunk and fell down those stairs, I'd have hurt myself. Never occurred to me if I hadn't have been drunk, I wouldn't have fallen down the bloody stairs. You know, you hear about alcoholic genius at a lot of these meetings, but it's the only place you ever hear about it is at these meetings. Most of us are not that bright. You know, when you can't figure that the thing that's killing you is killing you and you're taking it to cure you, hello? And so he says to me, I'm going to go to a meeting in the morning. Maybe you should come. And I said, what time's the meeting? And he said, 9 o'clock. I said, I'd love to go because I'm an alcoholic. Alcoholics will lie to you when the truth is good enough. I had no intention of going to that meeting. But I knew if I said I'd love to go, he'd shut up, and that's all I really wanted. He was too close. He'd gone too far in. He knew too much already. And he dropped me off at my house, and I had a restless night, and at 8 o'clock in the morning, I left. And he was in the car waiting for me. If you get a sponsor like the sponsor I had, you come to understand that they live in your head. They have intuition. They were liars themselves. They know whatever you're going to do. Do not try to run. Do not try to hide. It makes no difference. They know everything. He took me to that meeting, and this meeting was just incredible. I'm 23. Everybody there is like 107, maybe older. One guy, I don't know what was going, like they were going up some damn stairs or steps or stairs or something. I couldn't figure it out. Apparently there was 12 of these things, and they were all talking at the same time about different things, and all of a sudden it stopped, and then somebody was asked to share, and they'd talk, and then somebody talking a completely unrelated thing, and they would laugh at stuff that wasn't funny. You know, one guy got going about peeing his pants. I thought they were going to die laughing. The Thursday before, I had peed my pants. I didn't think there was anything funny. Nothing funny about peeing your pants, especially when it just happened to you. But you see, they've stopped peeing their pants. So now it's funny. Well, good for you. I'm so glad. Don't piss yourself, but don't call me anymore about it. You know what I'm saying? I don't need to share in your reveille over you're not pissing yourself when I'm still doing it. Let's go to the cancer ward and make some fun around people having cancer. I have problems. I wanted them all to understand. And I'm just sitting there. This is all going in my head, this raging, yelling, screaming, shut up, all of you! So, and they're drinking coffee. Now, I don't know if you drank coffee when you drank, but I never drank coffee. My dad used to say it's 50 cents. It's a hell of a way to screw up a $40 drunk. So I never drank coffee. But they're not. They're inhaling coffee. I'm expecting anyone, their colostomy bag is going to break and it's going to just shoot coffee all over. What the hell is wrong with these people? It's like, I figure, God, they're in the right place. There's no question about it. These people are nuts. And at the end of it, the part that was just mind-boggling was, the guy says, if you want what we have, and you're willing to go to any lengths to get it, I look around. Holy God, what do they got? You know, there's a bunch of old bastards. Most of them have no hair, no teeth. They're like how people leave the world. No hair, no teeth, no money. Everywhere, all around me. Do I want what they have? Let me think now. Oh, shit. They can't drink for the rest of their lives. Oh, yeah, that's great. Come here and drink coffee and urinate down your own... No, I don't want what they have. I didn't even know what they had. But I knew I did not want what they had. I was clear on that. Alcoholics are like that. You get them in a corner and you say to them, what do you want? They don't know, but they know what they don't want. They're very clear on what they... Because they focus on everything that's negative. That's all they think about is what's wrong. Alcoholics could fall into the best I ever heard it described was a barrel full of boobs and come up sucking their own thumb. I'm serious. I apologize for that. Somebody in here made me say that, so. Yeah. We are people who are focused on our own destruction. Some of you can't even laugh. You're so tied up in your own, you know. I'm serious. What the hell's he joking about, you know? Easy for him, the rich dork, you know. It's just, you know. Well, I'll tell you what. At this stage, when I discovered my own alcoholism, I had nothing. I was hopeless and I was helpless. And you know, the book says that we have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. It was at a place in my life where I just could not see my way around it. And I came out of that meeting and I didn't get any hope at my first meeting. I didn't get anything at my first meeting except aggravated. And so when we went outside and this guy says to me, "How did you like the meeting?" I said, "I loved it. I sure can see what you guys got going. That's great." I said, "Dwayne, I'm going to tell you something. I almost wish I was alcoholic, because you guys have got a thing going there, you know? In fact, if you need any money or anything I can do to help you, you call me." Like, I didn't have a nickel, but I was going to give them the money or the radio, whatever, however I can, you know, a big shot. And he said, "No, that'll be fine." And we got in the car and he drove me home and I figured, well, that's the end of that. And I went in the house and I said to my wife, "You'll never guess where I've been." I said, "I've been at a zoo looking at animals I do not want to identify with." And I told her some of the stories. She said, "Oh my God, Marty, that's terrible. Why don't you just slow your drinking down a little bit?" See, she didn't understand the nature. She doesn't understand like you understand if you're alcoholic. I can't slow it down because I can't take a drink without the phenomenon beginning of me wanting another drink. You see, non-alcoholics will be forever trying to understand why we're laying on the floor with our false teeth puked into the toilet, and somebody will say, "Can I help you?" And you say, "Yes, just give me another beer." Why would you want? "Because I'm thirsty, that's why." They would think apparently you've had enough, but you haven't had enough, because if you'd had enough, you wouldn't be thirsty anymore. Make sense? And so this powerlessness of mine was completely over the head of my poor wife. And she just thought I had a lack of control, or maybe not enough spine, or something like that. And there's nothing at all to do with that. In fact, I don't know about you, but I never ever craved a drink in my life when I wasn't drinking. I only crave it once I start to drink. Now, I was obsessed with the idea of getting drunk, I suppose, or not getting drunk, however you want to describe it. I was obsessed with the concept, I can't have fun unless I'm drinking. You know, I can't be intimate. Which every woman in here will testify how intimate us guys are when we're drunk, you know. It's like being at a smorgasbord, you know what I'm saying? Help yourself and clean up when you're finished. It's, yeah, and Johnny A., I think you said, is coming. Johnny gives the best description in the whole world of making love and then realizing his wife was watching him. He's by himself in the bed and... Yeah. My wife's world of understanding was everything that kept me drinking for a long, long time. And here's the other interesting thing about it was that night, even though I told him I didn't want to go, he came and picked me up for another meeting. And I thought I'd kind of explained myself, but I thought, oh, well, I'll go with the big dummy. They're so stupid, you know. They've had so much of their brain eaten up, he probably didn't understand. So I went to another meeting. Now, this meeting was, the group was called Mustard Seed. And at this meeting, there was a bunch of the ones from the first meeting and a couple of other ones and two women. So, hookers, I figure. Because... No, I didn't know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous. I figured absolutely everybody who's ever been in real trouble is in Alcoholics Anonymous, so it's probably hookers. So when the time came, you know, at the end of the meeting, they said, "Does the young guy have anything he'd like to say?" And I said, "Yeah, I got a question." And they said, "What is it?" And I said to these women, "Are you guys hookers?" And, yeah, Ruth said, no, I was never a hooker, but she said, "What I would do is, every once in a while, I'd get really drunk and then I'd pick up an anemic little turd like you and I'd take you home." Yeah. Don't mess with the alcoholic women in Alcoholics Anonymous. Tell you what, they've been there, done that. She humiliated me like I tried to humiliate her. And I went in that car, and now I was not mincing words with Dwayne anymore. I said, "I'm not going to any more meetings, so don't bother picking me up." He said, "Oh, yeah, you'll be at more meetings." I said, "I won't. I have rights." He said, "You have no rights." "Where the hell did you ever get that idea? You don't have any rights. You're an alcoholic." I said, "I'm not an alcoholic." "Yes, you are." He said, "You've been to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. The only people that ever go to Alcoholics Anonymous are alcoholics." I said, "Dwayne, I don't have to go to these meetings." He said, "Oh, yeah, you do." He said, "That's why we're anonymous. We're everywhere, and we're watching you. And let me tell you something else. If you decide to drink, Marty," he said, "let me tell you that all you have to do when you want to drink is you phone me, and I will bring you your first drink. And then I'm going to bust every bone in your body. And I said, Dwayne, why do you say these things to me like that? And, thank you. He said, it's really simple. If you drink, you're going to get hurt, and I really like you, and I don't want you getting hurt by strangers. Now, I don't know if you're lucky enough to have somebody that loves you like that. I don't know whether you understand that the way that they talk to you and seem to verbally abuse you are actually terms of endearment. I don't know if you understand that. I don't know if you understand how hard it is sometimes and how aggravating and how what a pain in the rear end it is to tell somebody the truth, because you've got to go through a whole bunch of abuse after you do it. But I want you to know, if you've got somebody like that in your life, thank God every single night, because that is actually what got me through to the place where I had enough of my mind come alert to say, maybe they've got something here. Maybe this is something that I want. Maybe I am ready to go to any length to get it. And so it took me that time to do the answer, which is step two. The question undoubtedly is step one, and the answer undoubtedly is step two, that I came to believe that a power greater than myself, brackets, Dwayne, bracket, was going to restore me to sanity. That's all I could see. You see, I didn't come here with two suitcases full of faith. I had been in and out of the churches. I had been in and out of the hospitals. I had come to understand with clarity that there's nothing there for me. Some other people seemed to get help, but there was never anything there for me, because eventually I would break out drunk and sometimes against my own will, and I thought there was just no hope. But inside this gorilla that God sent me named Dwayne, I saw a power greater than myself. And I turned my life and my will over to the power of that gorilla. You know, it's an interesting thing. About 120 days sober, I phoned Dwayne. I said, you know, I'm really having some trouble, Dwayne. He said, what is it? And I said, I can't turn my life over to God. And he said, why not? And I said, because if I turn my life over to God, he's going to send me to Africa as a missionary or something, and I've got this brand new baby and I can't go. He said, what would God do with an ass like you in Africa? You know, and as dumb as I was, I kept thinking, good point. That's a good point. That's an excellent point. You don't have to worry about anything grandiose. The problem with step two is it's something that you come to believe. You can't come to believe something and then believe it at the same time. You kind of come to that conclusion. So there's a place where it says, if you agree that the problem is this and you agree that the answer is this, you got to make a decision. And that's step three, you see. For me, the most important thing about a decision is that once you make it, it's irrevocable. You can't take it back. It's a decision. If you're sober on Wednesday and think you should get drunk on Monday, and you know you're not solid on anything, then what happens is that every single day of your life you get up, you got to make that decision again, which means you didn't make it last time. I'm going to tell you, the choices you'll have after you come here are legion. You'll have lots of choices, which group to go to, how many meetings you want to do a week, blah blah blah. But if you make a decision to turn your life and your will over to the care of a gorilla or a god of your own understanding, that is something that you do and you can't take back. Once you do that, you're here. And the days will turn into years and the years into decades, and someday we'll be sitting there with 48 years of sobriety, loved by a bunch of people in a room, just because we came to understand that we just don't have that decision to take back. And I did that. I turned it over as best as I knew how. Now, anybody in here realize that the people in Alcoholics Anonymous, that in those days they used to swear and smoke? And I mean, I came in here a complete pig, but I got so spiritual so fast I was of no earthly good. I mean, I really got spiritual. I went to the church. I figured I might as well be leading the church by the time I was there 2 or 3 weeks. I knew exactly what they should be doing. And in fact, Dwayne used to phone me up and tell me dirty jokes on the phone all the time, and I used to have to forgive him. It used to just tire me out. I'd forgive Dwayne 20, 30 times a day. Sunday morning, I'd get up, neighbors mowing the lawn. I had to forgive him. Oh, God, I was busy. Just self-righteous, you know. And it was interesting, one night he took me out in the car and he played me this tape, and it was a guy named Nestor Pister. It was a filthy comedy routine, and I said to Dwayne, you know, I don't have to listen to that crap. And you know, I guess old Dwayne had enough. He flipped. And he turned the car into the curb and he just about smashed the tires off the front of the thing. And he said, you know, I'm going to tell you something, Marty, and you just never forget this as long as you live. He said, I have more spirituality in my ass than you have in your entire body. So being the spiritual giant I was, I said to him, how do you know that? And he said, it's easy, Marty, because the God I understand is a God of peace and a God of serenity, and your God is madness and having to convince everybody that your way is the only way. And you know what, Marty? You're out. Tonight's your night. You're off the hook. He kicked me out of Alcoholics Anonymous. I hadn't been around long enough to know he couldn't kick me out of Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know the only requirement for membership was a desire to stop drinking. I thought it was a desire to please Dwayne. I had no earthly idea. I think that was the longest walk I ever took in my life. Kicked out of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I expected something bigger for myself than getting kicked out of Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't think it was that good a place anyway. You know, I phoned my mother and I said I joined Alcoholics Anonymous, and she said, oh, really? What will you do next to humiliate this family? Now I got to phone her and tell her I've been kicked out. Hello? Oh, God. So I decided that I'd go back to the church, and God's in church. God's in AA. God's in you. That's the interesting thing. It says in the book that the basic idea of God is deep within every man, woman, and child. That it's an inside job. God's been with us all along. You can't escape from, or it's the living, the essence of who you are. And so I'm out here trying to find this God thing, and all along it's inside of me. And all along it's guiding me, if I could only listen. But I had so many voices and so many different things in my head. I couldn't hear because of the fear. I couldn't see and I couldn't hear. And I was driven to try and do the next thing to solve the problem. See? That's the madness, that's sobriety. That's where the pressure builds to the place where someone like me has to take another drink. And on that walk home, I made some decisions. And I decided I was going to become a saint, you know. I'd go to Africa if they really needed me. Next day at the church, the pastor called me out in the hall. I don't know whether they planned this, reflecting on it right now, but the pastor said to me, when you're in church, he said, and I'm at the pulpit preaching, who's the audience? And I said, well, we are, the people. And he said, no. The audience is God. You see, God is watching as we're preaching, and like we're worshiping God. You see, he said, I think you got a lot of this stuff upside down and backwards. And he said, I'd like to really make a suggestion to you. He said, I think you should return to Alcoholics Anonymous. To the church. I mean, this sucks. Even drinking, I never got kicked out of the church. Well, there was the time when I was in grade 6, we got booted out for selling condoms. But the reason we did was because we were filling them with water and throwing them at cars. We were little kids. I didn't even know what they were. I just knew they really could whack a car. So I decided to go back to AA. Now, I don't know if any of you spiritual giants have ever been kicked out of AA and kicked out of a church, but when I went back to AA, there was an old boy, and oh, God, these old turtles are great. And I walked by him. His name was Jeff Charlebois. And I walked by Jeff and he said, there but for the grace of God goes God. Holy smoke! I had another spiritual awakening. It was huge. And I remember going with my sponsor and sitting in the car and saying, I've made such a fool of myself. And he was saying, Marty, you acted like a bloody alcoholic. You were trying to get too much of something right away. That's how alcoholics are. We can use up a month's supply of anything in 1 hour. All you were trying to do was just get more God than anybody else had. And he said, you know, for that I can't even be mad at you, but let's start and do this thing. And let's recognize that you're going to turn your life and your will, the things that you think, the things that you want, over to a power greater than yourself called Alcoholics Anonymous. Let's start, and just for a refreshing difference, let's do the steps. Well, there was a novel concept. I had never, ever thought that I would ever do the steps. But I did a step, searching fearless moral inventory of myself. You know, I didn't even know what a moral was. I didn't know what I was looking for. He said, let me make a suggestion. Write down everybody you're mad at right now. I said, let me make a suggestion. I'll write down the one person I'm not mad at. It would be quicker. You know, I was to learn later that resentments cut you off from the sunlight of the Spirit, and when you're cut off from the sunlight of the Spirit, insanity returns, and when insanity returns, people like me drink, and when people like me drink, we die, and therefore these madnesses, these resentments, these reoccurring bad feelings of mine actually did have the power to kill me. And I had to say to myself for once and forever, you know what, this isn't working. Why am I hanging on to this? And it came clear to me over a period of a couple of years what they meant when they said some of us try to hold on to our old ideas. So many of my old ideas are about who I'm blaming for whatever. So many of my old ideas are related to the fact that powerless people blame other people. And when you're powerless over alcohol, I spent more of my time trying to figure out who it was that was doing it to me instead of looking in the mirror and seeing the enemy. And so when they stand squarely in front of that searchlight and I start to sweep that across my life, I say, oh my God, in almost every instance, I either placed myself in the position to hurt somebody or I actually went out to hurt somebody. Every single time, all of these people are as much involved as victims in this damn thing as I am. I am not a victim. I'm an assassin. I'm a hitman. I'm an undercover agent. I'm a liar. I'm a cheat. I'm selfish and self-centered. Bob C. used to tell me, Marty, it's 7 o'clock. Go home and get in the chair and read page 62. And I'd go home and I'd open the book and I'd say, why do they make me read this? He said, driven by 100 forms of fear, selfishness, self-centeredness, and self-delusion, we step on the toes of our fellows and they retaliate, seemingly without provocation, but we invariably find it was us. Oh, man. And so I started to look at my life with a new pair of glasses, as our friend says in his book. A new pair of glasses that said that, geez, you know, I am not going to be powerless over my life forever. That I can bring some management into my life that's going to allow me to live as sanely as I choose to live. I can have the things in my life I choose. And what happened to me was that I replaced a bunch of old ideas in the autopilot section of my head with some new ideas that you guys had and were clearly working. And after a period of time without even thinking, I started to say, do, and be the things that I wanted to say, do, and be. It was amazing. I went through a complete transformation. I sat with a man and I admitted to him openly the nature of my wrongs. I said to him, I've done these things. And you know, it's an amazing thing. It says in the book, we can do this fifth step with our sponsors. We can do it with people of the clergy. I've done a number of them as a sponsor, and here's what I've learned. Every single person in this room's fifth step will sound astoundingly similar. You would be amazed at how unoriginal you are in your own filth. You would be absolutely amazed to learn how easy it is to fall asleep when somebody's laying their whole damn life out at your feet. Because it is rah-rah-rah-rah, same thing over and over. Drunks are deeply attached people, highly sensitive spiritual people. Every single thing that you've done is directed at destroying that spirit center. All you've ever done in terms of demoralizing yourself is try to humiliate yourself at a level where you can no longer stand it and you can scream for help. That's all you've been busy doing. So when you dump that trash in the fifth step, one of the most miraculous things that happens to a person like me is that I do become, for a period of time, entirely ready to have God remove these defects. And I've been in countless meetings all over the world, and I hear people talk about the fact that you know, God will not remove your defects and you can't. I want to tell you, stand here as a witness, that a number of defects I had when I got here, I can't even remember. And that just recently, February the 6th of 1999, I had a defect of character removed that I have had for 35 years. Almost 23 years sober, praying constantly that God would remove this thing from me. And it just wouldn't go and it wouldn't go. And on February the 6th, I woke up and I knew it was gone. I can't explain to you how that works. All I know is that if we keep coming, if we keep doing the work, if we keep staying willing, entirely ready, and humbly, which just simply means that I understand I cannot fix it. I cannot understand it and correct it. I am not going to have some human power reach down and go, oh, there, you don't have that anymore. Doesn't work like that for people like me. I need to have this power within myself get to a place where I've either had enough humiliation. As Father Eddie said, alcoholics may never get into heaven. Forwards, they may come marching in on their knees. But realize that when you're there long enough and you're sincere enough, at some point the power will remove that thing when it stands in the way of your being of maximum use to your fellows. And so I don't even know how to begin to thank God that that stupid nonsense has gone out of my life. It's gone. So I believe that you can have things removed. I believe that some people gain humility through a series of humiliations. You know, I was one of those people in Alcoholics Anonymous that had such an ego that they had to deflate me at really great depth. I know some of you are thinking it's not gone yet. It's not. And shame on you for judging me. I remember telephone rang one night and it was my sponsor and he said, "Oh, you got to come to Swift Current and hear this speaker. Man, this guy's an authority on humility." And I said, "Well, I don't think I can go. I'm busy." And he said, No, you got to go. Marty," he said, "one day you're going to be a world caliber speaker. You know that, don't you?" And I said, "Oh, yeah." And he said, "Well, you know, you got to get this humility thing nailed." And I said, "So this guy can, is that good?" He said, "You can't miss this guy." So I canceled whatever it was I had. We went down to this place, 500 people in the room. Man, it was incredible, electricity in the room. They introduced the speaker. It was me. I mean, the blood just came out of my face. Like, what are you talking about? So anyway, I went to the front of the room and I said, I would just like to listen tonight. Thank you very much. You know, I was like, it was off. Oh, it was humiliating. But you see, he was trying to deflate me. And when we got in the car, I said, "I get it. Okay. I get it. I'm not going to be a speaker. Okay." He said, "Where the hell did you ever get that idea? You're going to speak." He said, "You're speaking next weekend." I said, "No, I'm not." He said, "Yeah, you are." I said, "Dwayne, I got up there. I didn't have a thing to say." He said, "I will give you something to say. We'll practice your talk." 7 hours in the car, we rehearse my talk. Sunday morning comes, introduce the speaker. It was him. That's deflation. That's deflation at great depth. Humiliation is what you get when you don't have humility. I've had more humiliation sober than I ever had drunk. I can't remember a lot of this stuff. I don't know about your God, but my God used to just wake me up for the bad parts. You know what I mean? I mean, if I fluked up and landed sleeping with Marilyn Monroe, I wouldn't remember it. But I'll tell you what, pee in a fishbowl, I'm awake for the whole trip. You know what I'm saying in the morning? Oh, man, did I do that? So, humiliation is more to do... I used to say in my home group, you know, I've got a God-shaped hole inside of me. There's nothing will fill the hole except God. You can put liquor in it, cocaine, wacky, it doesn't matter what you put in the hole, money, prestige, position, it will not fill this God-shaped hole. And humiliation always comes for me when I'm stuffing something in there that won't work. And it's like getting caught in front of your parents stealing. It's like it's in front of this deep sense of who and what you really are. This horrible realization sneaks up to you. Oh my God, I'm doing that in front of him. And that kind of humiliation for me is usually inside. I'm not a person that gets red in the face, but I've gone out of these rooms 100 times, got in the car and said, "Oh, why do you do that stuff? I don't want to be like that anymore." And I'd say to God, as I understand it, humbly, remove these defects of character that drive me to be like that. And what I found out in that searching moral inventory was there was not a great number of defects of character. That I'm selfish, I'm self-centered, I'm dishonest, and I'm fearful. That's just about all that's wrong with me. And when I get really fearful, I do things to try and not be fearful. Sometimes I get aggressive with other people and I hurt them. When I'm being selfish, I don't notice what other people's needs are. About 2 years ago, I was driving down the road and I thought, "Oh my God, if I'd only known this when I was 18 and had hair, I'd have been a stud." Well, okay, imagine it, all right? Can you imagine, gentlemen, if you had actually thought about what the woman would have liked at 18? They'd have thought you were Romeo or something. Men are pigs. You know, we just did what we wanted to do, where we wanted to go, blah, blah, blah. Alcoholics are just like that. When I start to wonder what it is you need and I start to try to provide that thing for you, the one thing I want more than anything else in the world that selfishness and self-centeredness can't bring me comes to me, love. See, that's the part that fills the God-shaped hole. When that stuff starts to come back to you and seemingly unrelated to the actions you're taking, you're on the beam. That's when they say you're doing the program. When you humbly ask God to remove these defects of character, and for just a period of time in your head, you're clear on what somebody else might want. You're clear on how to help somebody else. And then, you know, my experience is this. What we are like now is that a bunch of things have come to me as the result of reprogramming these old patterns. You know, I have no fear of financial insecurity. By the way, that doesn't mean you're going to get rich or even have money. It just means you won't be afraid to be broke anymore. See, from step 8 on, I go outside of my body for the first time. Up until now, all I've been doing is working on me. And now I start to go outside of that wreckage and say, what could I, for the first time in my life, start to put back? And this is where the joy of the program starts to come. This is the stuff you hear the old timers at the meeting talk about and you think, yeah. I don't think I'll ever have that. You'll have that the minute that you say you want that. The minute that you say, I'm ready now to make a list of everyone I've harmed. I'm now ready to make amends wherever I possibly can. Although I will never do that if it's going to hurt them more or hurt somebody else. I'm ready to go and start to put back into the world the things that I started to steal out of the world. I want to start to live my own life tall in my own eyes. I don't know if you know what I'm talking about when I say this, but I spent the first half of my life trying to impress everybody else that I was okay. I'm spending the last half of my life trying to impress me that I'm okay. Doing the stuff that does not come easily for me, like this talk. Some of you look hot and tired and sick of listening to me, and I'd just as soon sit down and shut up so you could go home. But I know I've got some other things that I just want to say to you, and then I will stop. Alcoholics Anonymous is about this concept of seeking through prayer, which is just basically talking even within yourself. Prayer and meditation, which is more to do with this concept of getting quiet. People say that it's talking and listening to God. That's okay, but I don't know. Sometimes I have to really work to get the noise in my head down to a level where if God said anything, I'd hear him. Serious. I was in Hawaii one time to give an AA talk. I was telling Lenny this earlier in the day. And I was standing in the sun was going down, and all of a sudden I felt so small and so inadequate and so insufficient to go and give that talk. You know, I started thinking, why would they invite me? I'm an idiot. I don't know anything. What the hell am I going to say to these people? Because, you know, the alcoholic wants to have a reputation, but deep down inside basically understands he doesn't deserve it. That's what I had done, is I developed this outside character, but inside I had not won my own approval. And I heard a voice in my head as clear as you can hear me right now. It was my own voice. And the voice said, just tell them to believe their own miracles. And I thought, good talk. Thanks for sharing. Like, the hell do I talk for the rest of the talk? So I go to this meeting and I deliver a very mediocre talk. Just a talk. And I say, oh, by the way, God told me something to tell you. A couple of the guys in the front, very interesting, isn't it? I said, God told me to tell you guys, you got to learn to believe your own miracles. Thank you. And I sat down. And the people came up, as they do at Alcoholics Anonymous. And some of them listened to you to learn, others listened to you to love you back to health. And they were hugging me and telling me to keep coming back. And this guy came up and he said, you know, I've been drunk off and on for 11 years. 11 years. I haven't been able to get this thing. And he said, I will never drink again. And I said, because of my talking? He said, no, because when you said that thing about the miracles, he said, I had almost like a screen go across my eyes of all of the miracles that have happened in my life. I've never seen them before. I've never believed them before. And I just intuitively know I'm going to be okay. And he left. And I thought, man, oh man, they probably spent $3,000 or $4,000 getting me here to talk to one guy. If there's only one person in this room tonight that heard what I'm trying to say here tonight, I had a good night. Because it works like that. If you don't like me, that's no big deal. There is some speaker somewhere you are going to like, because that'll always happen. Sometimes you have to go through a whole pile of just listening until it's your turn. And then one night somebody will sing that music that you can hear right to your interior soul. You will have had a spiritual awakening. And as the result of that, you will take this new attitude in life where you start to understand that it's more important to give than it is to get, to understand than to be understood, to love rather than to get love. You come to understand that we are actually catapulted, as Bill says, into a fourth dimension of living. And this only comes one way, of which I know, and that's to do the steps. The steps are the only thing that will take this noisy receiver I call a mind, this hormone pump called a brain, and get it onto one frequency so that just for a short period of time, I can hear something with clarity that I can actually understand at a level that's so deep, I start to get results. See, and results are what it's all about. Did you guys ever hear the story about the Portland alcoholic cab driver that had the preacher in the back and had the accident? They were both went to heaven. And of course, they take the preacher off first and they put him in this little place. It's just a little place, a little white fence around him. Not much goes on. This cab driver. The driver, my God, is a pain. And the man, and on, and the preacher gets the crowd out of the front of them and says, crowd out of the crowd, this says, the mistake. I'm the priest in the church. He said, yeah. He's all drunken, and everybody was praying. So what's life is 3 years ago, I went to a place I didn't want to go. The person didn't like to live like they're stuck. Putting up. And one night the phone rang, as the phone will ring in Alcoholics Anonymous, and they said, Father Pete can't go to speak in this little town. Would you cover for him? And I said, yeah, I'll go. And I went there, and there was a woman spoke. And she spoke my worst fears. She told how that her oldest son had a tractor roll over on him and kill him. And she told how that a year after that, her son went down the basement with a rope, and he hung himself. And she'd lost two sons in 1 year, and she phoned her mother and father to come home, and the second oldest went downstairs to the same bar and put the rope around there to see how his brother had done it, apparently, and he hung himself. She had 3 dead children in 1 year. And as she spoke, I couldn't even hold it in anymore. It was like somebody was speaking my absolute worst fears out loud. And I said to her after the meeting, I said, how do you live through that? And she said, you don't live through that. You can't live through that. You have to come to a new place where you understand these kids are not your kids. They're God's kids, and He'll take them home when He chooses to take them home. They're only on your bus for a short time, and I would suggest you go home and start learning from your son like you were meant to learn from your son and appreciate them while you have them, because it's all on his clock, not yours. And she said, I will spend the rest of my life carrying that message, because that's what I was sent here to do and to teach. I was released. Everything you need, you will get in Alcoholics Anonymous. It may not be what you want, but you will get what you need in Alcoholics Anonymous. And we have people in this very room that have lived through huge tragedies in their lives, and they are an inspiration to the rest of us because they keep coming here. And that's what we have, a shared experience based on an openness and a willingness to share the good and the bad. And Alcoholics Anonymous is probably the most evolutionary growing experience you'll ever have in your life. You'll learn how to cry again, you'll learn how to laugh again, but you never have to drink again. You never have to pick up again. And all you have to do is come be with a bunch of silly people every once in a while that run raffles, that don't talk very nice about each other at the public level, that basically would die for one another in a pinch. As Bill said, we are a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other, that we might overcome our common problem, selfishness and self-centeredness. Thank you and good night.